Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, December 19th, and 2024. We have a new guest, Lasha Khosrowshahi. He's an international relation analyst with the focus on the states of the former Soviet Union. He focuses on the South Caucasus and the Black Sea regional affairs. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Nima. This is my first time, as you mentioned, so I appreciate the opportunity.
And anybody who's interested to know about him is in the description. I put his introduction in the description, and you can access that and you see his expertise. Lasha, let's get started with what's going on right now in Georgia, which is of great importance, in my opinion, in terms of the conflict in Ukraine and the future of the conflict between the United States and Russia. What do we know, and how can we understand the situation right now in Georgia?
Well, Nima, I will just start by saying the obvious. I think what's happening in Georgia is the signs of relative decline, not complete, but relative decline in influence and power of the sort of neoconservative state capture to which Georgia has been subjected for the past 20 to 30 years, especially in the past since 2003 up until 2012. When the previous government, the United National Movement government, ran the country, that was considered to be the darling of Washington. And that era is coming to not a complete end, but to a relative decline. What we are seeing today in Georgia in terms of demonstrations, in terms of not the opposition parties and some radical factions not wanting to recognize elections and with accusations of wanting to overthrow the democratically elected government, the elections that took place on October 26th, is that order, the usual sort of neocon, neoliberal influence in Georgia is coming to sort of a relative end, if you will. That's basically the reaction manifestation of reaction within the opposition and other radical forces that are all connected, basically, that are stirring the trouble. Do I think this is going to go anywhere? I don't. In other words, I don't think there is a sort of a Rose Revolution substance. If you recall, the Rose Revolution was the revolution that brought the previous government to power back in 2003. I don't think it's nearly that serious or has enough sort of a substance, both politically and practically, to support this movement to sustain what's happening in Georgia now.
I've heard something so strange about Georgia that the former president of Georgia, she was born in France and she was a politician in France. She had some sort of position in NATO, and then coming to Georgia, being the president of Georgia, how is that possible with the constitution of Georgia?
That's an excellent question, actually. I believe she's a dual citizen, in Georgia, these things go, somehow they are sold through politicking and through political processes. On the technical sort of judicial side of how she became the president, in terms of, I think she was a dual citizen. She became a dual citizen. I believe they she was promoted as a candidate for presidency by the Georgian Dream, actually, ironically, and the current government, ran for president. And basically she was the entire Georgian dream stood behind her. So, in terms of sort of legal matters of how she became president, I'm not quite clear. She's pretty sure she's a citizen of Georgia also. Georgia's presidency became more of a ceremonial position. Prime ministership is the position that holds power constitutionally now, because of the excesses of the Saakashvili era, when he was this sort of, they called him soft autocrat, but he was this very autocratic leader in Georgia, supported by Washington, Brussels, of course, after he lost elections in 2012, they switched it and they turned the president's position into a more ceremonial position. Nevertheless, it's obviously a very prestigious position in Georgia and very sought after, but coveted position. But what's happening now with Salome Zurabishvili? Yes, she's she made her career in France. She's a Georgian, French Georgian, ethnically Georgian, but lived and studied and worked in France. And she was an ambassador to Georgia years ago, and then the Georgian Dream, the current government, now she hates, perhaps is the word to use, brought her to power, and she turned basically against them. One could make that conclusion, what happened was there was a chasm that appeared between the Georgian Dream and her. She is, I am sure, this is in my opinion, in my analysis, very much influenced by Brussels. And yet at the same time, I would argue that she doesn't have much backing, much substantial backing from Brussels. This is mostly sort of a politicized backing and sort of defense, political defense of her that comes out of Brussels and Washington, to much less extent, I would say, from Washington. Yes, she made her career in France, and now she's saying that she will not leave the actual building where the president sits in Tbilisi. She's supposed to leave that building on the 29th of December. This is sort of becoming a laughable, ridiculous situation where people are making jokes about Madame Salome Zurabishvili being dragged out of the building physically if she decides to become stubborn. So it's getting to be a circus. Legally, sort of in terms of today's constitution, her presidential term expires on the 29th.
When you look at Georgia right now, I think what's happening in Georgia and the conflict in Ukraine are totally connected. In your opinion, what would be the new policy under Donald Trump in Georgia? Right now, let's put it this way, before going to Donald Trump, do you think that the current situation in Georgia would have some sort of benefit for the region and Georgia? Or we're gonna deal with a new color revolution or something of that sort in Georgia?
Absolutely. That's an excellent question. In the beginning when I mentioned that this whole neoliberal, neoconservative theater is sort of coming to relative end, that's what I meant. I don't think that today we have the same sort of atmosphere, same political climate that brought the Rose Revolution into Georgia, and then Orange Revolution, say, in Ukraine. This is a different time period. I think it has to do with the change in the international system that reflects Georgia and the region, meaning, we all know that basically there is a consensus among scholars, experts, and folks who watch this, that from the unipolar moment, the unipolar world is basically over. And now America is facing the so multipolar world with the rise of China and Russia, that changes the calculus, which reflects on regional politics and the regional sort of geopolitics. Georgia is that, South Caucasus is that region. I have never seen, this is the first time I'm seeing in the last 30 years, stubborn, if you will, principled stance against the Washington's directives and Brussels coming from Georgia. And so that, I think, explains a lot in terms of the changes we see in the international system, which I think is the main reason why this is happening. Because only 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I wouldn't think that Georgia would dare to resist, America in this regard. And yet we are seeing a sort of principled stance on part of Tbilisi, official Tbilisi, on the matters of, regional politics and international relations and Georgia's role in the region. And I have to be careful here to sort of, if you don't mind, I'll just explain in more detail to your audience what I mean. We all know that 2003 brought to power the United National Movement that was sort of this, darling of Washington, so to speak. Saakashvili became sort of George W. Bush's favorite. And he was being presented to the rest of the world and the region as this great reformer. To a certain extent, he was. We have to be fair here. He did implement some very necessary reforms. But then after 2005, things deteriorated where he started to concentrate power into his own hands and his own cronies and henchmen, really. They basically took over the entire city, the country, under the following phrases such as freedom agenda, libertarianism in terms of economics, they basically ran the country exclusively, confiscating businesses at 4 a.m. in the morning, from private owners under fear, became sort of a daily routine. All was done under libertarianism, which is puzzling because libertarian sort of economics is all about leaving private property alone and not interfering in businesses and sort of the entrepreneurial life. But that was the exact opposite that was happening. And then in terms of democracy promotion and freedom agenda, human rights record declined drastically. I think, if I'm not mistaken, there was this famous or infamous figure, 0.01% of acquittal rating that characterized Saakashvili's rule. They were even comparing him to neighboring, Belarusian president's record was better. I'm not trying to sort of disrespect any other country or system, but just for the comparison reasons, it became sort of anecdotal evidence. I mean, people just lived in fear. Towards the end, and all of this was basically covered up as the Freedom Agenda program, democracy promotion program, and then Bush finally, when he was a historic trip, I must admit, traveled to Tbilisi, I think it was in 2005, he was calling Georgia, beacon of liberty, and nothing was further from the truth. I mean, it was not a free country, some of the consulting that I do for the television station, that very television station in Georgia was basically raided by Saakashvili's, in the middle of the live, in the middle of live. Broadcasting, and they just shut it down because some owners there were against Misha. He was called Misha Mikhail Saakashvili. And so he shuts down this television station, and then Washington sort of brushes it off, of course, with slight criticism. Why I'm saying this is that the reason I'm saying this is because this is the type of sort of a brushing off effect that with which the UNM got away. But now, factually speaking, the current government is much more democratic. The confiscation and illegal sort of shutting down of businesses under threats is over, basically. I don't know of any serious case so far that might have come about, but sort of this overall, autocratic sort of what some call even terror has ended. And yes, the current government, they're not perfect, far from it. But in terms of being sort of truly democratic, relatively speaking, of course, there is no consolidated democracy in Georgia. It's still a sort of, some call it hybrid regime or transitional country. There's so many names for that. But, it's undeniable that the current government is much softer, so to speak. Because they've decided to, they looked at the past, they looked at 2008, as you may remember, when Russia invaded Georgia in August, as a result of this whole extreme sort of foreign policy towards Georgia from Washington, pushing NATO into the South Caucasus. We all remember the Bucharest summit, the infamous where they left Ukraine and Georgia in limbo, where Bush insisted, Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy resisted, but he still made Georgia and Ukraine on the paper as someday potential, maybe if potential members of NATO, which left them even in a worse position geostrategically and geopolitically speaking, and in terms of security, of course, which many connect Russia's invasion of Georgia directly to that decision. And so the NATO expansion in the South Caucasus, as bizarre as that sounded and seemed and has become known, was majority sort of the main reason why Russia did invade Georgia in 2008. And so the current government looked at, this brief but very tragic history when Georgia came very close to losing its statehood, and said, this is unsustainable. We cannot be used as battering rams against Moscow. And Georgia needs to step back and not reevaluate. I have to be very careful here. Georgia remains to be a pro-Western country, and current government has done everything in terms from visa liberalization to membership status eventually to become member of the European Union, but still it's not enough for this globalist agenda, the neoconservative agenda. And any attempt by the Georgian government, I would say very pragmatic and very shrewd, very necessary attempt to step back from this madness where Georgia was being used as a battering ram against Russia, and say, look, we need to look at our own geopolitics. It's a very geopoliticized region, if I may use that word in that manner, because it's a very rigid, tight. I mean, we have Iran, we have Turkey, we have obviously Russia, and Georgia has found good relations with everyone except Russia, where that relationship is also possible. There is plenty of room to improve that relationship. But when they started to do it, all of a sudden they became anti-Western, anti-America, anti-Europe, and pro-Russian. When fundamentally speaking, we know what we're dealing with. We're dealing with Georgia's pragmatic politics application of basic principles of international relations, and that is for survival of the small state. That has to be number one priority, which had been forgotten. And now that principle sort of is coming back out of necessity. I don't know if of a Georgian who will tell me, I want Russia and I don't want Europe. That's another irony of this whole situation. Out of necessity and out of pragmatism and sort of geopolitical principles, they've changed the tune. And basically they said, look, we need to find a common ground with Russia because we will disappear. And there is no one. What makes this even more cynical and what is worst about it is that United States is not coming to Georgia's aid. We saw this in 2008, and much less Europe. So that's the motivating factor right now why Tbilisi is doing this, and why Tbilisi has become the subject of this punishment, so to speak.
But I do believe that the United States would use Georgia and together with the European Union as a buffer zone. They don't, if something big happens, they're going to use it. And in your opinion, right now, this decision makers in Georgia are closer to the vision of Orban and Fico, or they're mostly think the way that the Western Europeans are thinking of Ukraine? I'm talking about the conflict in Ukraine. How do they see the conflict in Ukraine?
Georgians,
decision makers in Georgia.
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, Hungary has vetoed the sanctions that are being imposed or are being planned to be imposed on Georgian politicians, the government. It is absolutely, I'll confess to your audience, to me, it's so ridiculous and laughable that it's not even worth looking into when Washington says that they're going to impose sanctions on Georgia, arguably the most loyal republic in the region, to Washington and to Brussels and to the cause of joining the West. You know, what are they going to sanction? Few politicians or Georgia's economy, which is minuscule compared to, say, even Ukraine's. And so this is becoming, you know, laughable, really. And you know, it's very hard to make a serious analysis on that. But nevertheless, it is happening. And the U.S. State Department, even several times, I believe, said that they were going to plan to impose sanctions. Be that as it may, So what's happening with the current government and their sort of disposition towards Ukraine is directly related to what I've said. So first, let me just backtrack again. So you recall when the first NGO laws were adopted, and you know, things became very chaotic. Another political upheaval was in the air, and demonstrators came out in the streets en masse, protesting this law. Prior to that, there has always been this story, that allegation, and some say that it was a 100% accurate allegation, that the European Union and Washington were pressing Georgia to open up the second front against Russia in support of Ukraine's war. Well, that was going to be a suicide. That was going to be a national suicide. Georgia was going to end as the state. So obviously, very bravely, in my opinion, the Georgian dream resisted it. And so I would just connect everything that's happening now with that whole push to open up the second front. If it's true, I mean, I don't have the exact documentation, but that information has become so public and has become so potent that I doubt that it was a lie. I mean, and then knowing the U.S. foreign policy, I wouldn't be surprised. Let me just put it that way, just to stay on the safe side. So, Georgian dream would not just, in a crazy manner, sort of accuse Washington or Brussels of compelling them to open up the second front. That would have been an extremely serious accusation. So there must be some substance to it. And so that whole political energy was created, has lasted up to this day, where we are seeing still folks out in the streets protesting the results of the elections. So it's this whole sort of this morass of the process of accusations of compelling allegedly Georgia to open up the second front, Georgia's government issuing the law to check the sort of free flow of cash to NGOs that have enormous influence in Georgia, enormous influence. I always say this. I don't know of in a Western country where the NGOs are so powerful that they can overthrow the government, or at least political sort of processes in place that could bring up the bring down the government. The current government initiated this law. They approved it, which, by the way, the Brussels has it too, and many European countries have it. But for some reason, Georgia is the problem. To go back to your point, their disposition towards Ukraine is exactly what they've experienced themselves, meaning in 2008 we survived. Principles and the logic behind that invasion, Russia's invasion of Georgia, was the same. Expansion of NATO, same thing with Ukraine, expansion of NATO, ignoring of every red line that Moscow had regarding that process. This doubling down, sort of expansionist, liberal, hegemonic policy that basically sacrificed Ukraine. And Georgia decided whatever was left of it to step back and say, enough is enough. And that created sort of the overall process that we are seeing today, that there was a sort of the previous, dynamic that led up to what we are seeing today. It never stopped, actually. It just, continues and ebbs and flows.
Do you find Donald Trump's position right now is he's interested in the situation in with Georgia, or he's going after some sort of new policies in that region?
I'll say this about Donald Trump. Donald Trump's presidency has been very much anticipated in Georgia. Everybody talks about Donald Trump's presidency. I will say a few things on Donald Trump. Personally, I think his instinct is such that he doesn't want America's adventurism. He doesn't like it. He doesn't like the overextension, sort of this liberal internationalism, this involvement in overthrows or invasions or egging on small states against major states. He wants that to end. I think if you look at his foreign policy map, his picture, what I just said is most realistically going to be implemented towards Moscow and towards Ukraine. So figuring out what to do with Ukraine, meaning how to stop that conflict. I think he will be more invested in achieving that goal than in other parts of the region, the Middle East, for example. I think he remains hawkish on Iran, and how he will remain hawkish on support of Israel. But that's slightly separate, even though that what's happening in Syria now could also flow over into the South Caucasus, but we're not there yet. Although that, relatively speaking, that risk exists. For going back to his views on Russia, Putin, and how to stop this conflict, I think he will put, more political resources of his administration into figuring out how to stop this conflict. This is going to cost Ukraine a lot, in my opinion, territories, etc., even though we know that there have not been any specifics about how he's supposed to do it. And that whole 24-hour comment he made during his presidential campaign, I mean, obviously we know that it was just a political speak, but concretely speaking, we still don't have a deep sense of how he's going to do this. Whatever the deal is going to be, I think is going to cost Ukraine more than Russia. Ukraine is existential for Russia. We know this geostrategically, geopolitically. That, by the way, goes back to the early 90s when some of the hawks today were saying, look, this is the brightest of red lines. Mr. Perry, the you know, former ambassador to Moscow, you know, would say, and anybody from, you know, George Kennan to, you know, when he was still alive back in the, you know, 90s, that would say that this was going to be a very serious problem, not to mention the scholarly community for, you know, John Mearsheimer and, you know, and so forth. And so the whole realist school, if you will, has triumphed on this. I mean, let's be honest here. And so, you know, we are seeing those predictions unfold, but, you know, Washington will continue to double down. To what extent, we don't know. We also know that the outgoing President Biden is doing everything he can to complicate the process, to leave a mess for the incoming president. One of the first things that occurred to me was when the attackams were green lighted for Kiev, I said, look, this is all done to complicate life for Trump when he comes into the White House. But yeah, just to split sort of potential decision making between, say, the Middle East and Russia-Ukraine war, I think, President-elect Trump will look at Ukraine from the principles of peacemaking, and which is a slightly different scenario that is facing sort of the Middle East.
I think one of the main questions right now in the mind of Russians and Putin and his administration is, what would be the new surprise coming from the Biden administration? Are they going to give Ukrainians, I don't know, a dirty bomb, something, a tactical nuclear bomb? And do you see the desperation in Washington? When you look at the desperation in Washington and the way that they're trying to send more aid and weapons and they're putting some sort of pressure on the Zelensky administration to reduce the draft age from 25 to 18. In my opinion, nobody cares about Ukrainians and what has happened to these people in Ukraine. Ukrainian as a nation, and it's gone, it's all gone, but they're trying to continue. How do you find the situation right now? Are we going to have some sort of new escalations before Donald Trump come into power?
It is impossible to predict, Nima, but I would not be surprised if they came up with some crazy trick that will destroy Ukraine even more. There is this sort of, I don't mean to be all philosophical here, but sort of this teleological take within the U.S. foreign policy where they're waiting for some historic breakthrough where everything will become perfect. This sort of, I don't know, dialectic, you know, ideological approach to these things. When you see the reality in front of you and you're still ignoring it and you are going about it in this messianic, you know, worldview, messianic sort of approach that you have, this is the result you get. You know, while that might sound too dramatic, I mean, it is, in my opinion. That's what this whole foreign policy ideology has been about. It's very messianic, ideological, and they just don't care. Some say these people truly believe in what they do, and to a large extent, I agree with that. Yes, they believe that somehow America is going to go out there and sort of flatten the world where there won't be any hierarchies, geopolitical hierarchies, and other types of hierarchies, say, for example, in sociocultural issues that has more to do with these culture wars and sort of globalist movement, where they will have to just sort of flatten everyone's interests so that, you know, in this democratic peace theory will go out there and will be exported and there will be no conflicts and it will just be, you know, a huge sort of a money-making operation. This is to allude to John Mearsheimer's argument that, you know, it was peace and love and dope were supposed to come in and sort of take over the world. But fundamentals were ignored. That's what I'm trying to say. And fundamentals of geopolitics and national security and state interests were ignored under this ideology. Ironically, behind the scenes, everyone understood that, yes, these are narratives, and yet behind it, there is this ruthless foreign policy taking place out of Brussels and Washington, that is more than willing to start wars, to engage in these regional flare-ups, to achieve that vision that I just described, without, by the way, sacrificing their own resources, right? You know, America is in a great position geopolitically, in the between two large bodies of water. You know, no one could touch the United States in terms of, you know, security. The same with, say, with, you know, Europe. You know, this whole myth that Russia is going to, after Ukraine, you know, knock off Eastern Europe and then go into Western Europe. This is part of that whole ideology. And nothing could be further from the truth. Russia's resources are stretched to the maximum, I believe, in Ukraine. While these current sanctions did not really do much against Russia, no one exactly knows what the effects are going to be, you know, in the long term. There have been some studies that this is going to affect them negatively in the long term, but it doesn't seem that way now. So Putin has played his hand very strategically and very smartly. And so, you know, sort of to your point, back to your point, yeah, you know, Ukraine conflict is part of this, you know, this notion that the indispensability of the United States has to be constant and perpetual. You know, there is no need for these, though, in reality. Ukraine war could have very well been avoided. We know this now, not just because of the Istanbul communique that took place in March of 2022, that was basically cut off short when Russia was promising plenty to Ukraine and to the West. But nope, it was not allowed to. But Kiev was not allowed to listen to Russia and sign up to that proposal. And now we're seeing what's happening in Syria. And, you know, one has to, you know, ask a question, you know, what is the end goal here? Because no matter how powerful the United States is, and it's still the most powerful, in relative terms, its power has declined slightly, but it's still the most powerful nation on the planet. And I live here for 30 years. I've lived here. It really makes no sense. This has been the tradition of the United States now for the past 20 to 30 years, longer, obviously, but focusing on the most recent adventurisms. You know, the question is, what is the end purpose? Is Russia going to disappear? Is the Middle East going to disappear? All these people we don't like around the world, are they going to disappear? If one disappears, another will come up. So what is the end? How can this be sustainable moving forward? I think that's the main question. And it's not. It can be. And so in international affairs and international system, you know, we are seeing now the return of great power politics, right? So this, the tragedy of great power politics, right? That's what it is, where people, you know, major states are saying, look, enough is enough. We have our own interests. And to what extent this sort of glossing over their interest, you know, is going to be sustained, I don't know. But we are seeing the facts on the ground. It cannot be sustained. People, you know, certain states will oppose. And that's what we are seeing now. In Georgia, just to go back to Georgia real quick, you know, it has figured this out. I mean, they looked at the international system, the changing environment, and they said no one has come to our aid. No one was planning to come to our aid. This whole narrative of NATO expansion and the rest of the normative sort of foreign policy that Georgia has been at the recipient end of, it has not worked. And yes, Georgians are very much thankful for United States, support in terms of Georgia's, you know, national security, you know, sort of territorial integrity and non-recognition of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the separatist regions backed by Russia. But that is, as fundamental as that is, has not guaranteed Georgia A, not security, and B, any economic development, any industrialization. It hasn't happened. So, you know, obviously the natural reaction from the current government was to engage in some pragmatic foreign policy towards Moscow.
Right now, with the situation in Ukraine, I don't believe that Russia would give back any territory that they have captured so far. More than We're approaching 3 years of this conflict in Ukraine, and they have been fighting so hard in Ukraine, and it's so unrealistic if we think that they can give up any of these territories that are in right now in the hand of Russians. But the question I think right now, in case of the conflict in Ukraine, would be what is the future of Odessa and Nikolaev? Specifically Odessa, we know that Ukrainians are not good in keeping their promises, their agreements with the Minsk 1 and 2. And Russia knows that. Russia knows how the West would behave in any sort of violation of the agreement with Ukrainians. They would support Ukrainians again and doing a new mess in that region. Do you think that Odessa would play a very crucial and key role in any sort of agreement between the West and Russia? Or would Russia give it to Ukrainian, or there going to be some sort of autonomy for that region, for the city?
I don't think so. I think at this point, Russia will take everything that it can take, short of Kiev. Odessa is a key state, key region. Black Sea, Russia needs that. You know, when the communique happened, took place in Istanbul, there was a conversation that there was the possibility of Russia, even in 15 years or so, giving Crimea back to Ukraine. And there was even a conversation, they even acquiesced to Ukraine becoming a member of the European Union. As long as the West made sure that Ukraine became a neutral state with guarantees of security for Russia, meaning no NATO. Samuel Cherub from the RAND Corporation, I think, had a very exhaustive piece on that meeting. I just recall his name. He's an expert in IR, and he's with the RAND Corporation, I believe. And Foreign Affairs, he had a piece where he talks about these things. Naftali Bennett, I think, was the facilitator of that conversation. He was shocked to, he even asked Zelensky if he truly believed that Washington was going to come and aid Kiev against Russia. And he received this, I'm paraphrasing, of course, some very vague and naive responses. So everyone understood from day one that this was a big game. This was just like since the 18th century, 19th century, this was an attempt to weaken, if not completely destroy, Russia. Ukraine, the South Caucasus, these are the geopolitical spaces, if you will, through which the soft underbelly of Russia. Just to mention another book by a Georgian author, Mamulia, he even researched it to the point where there was a connection between Japan, the South Caucasus republics, and the West back then with the British Empire, how to weaken and destroy the then Tsarist Russia. And that could not work. So can you imagine Japan, half the world away from the Caucasus, conniving with Georgia and Azerbaijan and Armenia? I think all three republics were involved. How to weaken Russia? So this is something. And then, of course, the British foreign policy, the imperial foreign policy, and Lord Palmerston that brilliantly was described constantly. Professor Jeffrey Sachs always talks about it, how the British had designs on Russia, and this region was just merely meant as an instrument, as a launching pad against Russia, and nothing more. And maybe Baku's oil, of course. But this got a huge historic sort of backing. This is not just this; this has happened through in the post Cold War era. So to give you sort of a long answer to your question, I don't think. Yeah, I mean the. Everybody sort of anticipates, is Odessa next? It's a very strategic city. It's impossible to predict and pinpoint when and if, but the fact that Russia is not going to give up an inch of territory that it sees as strategically important for Moscow is obvious at this point. They just don't even want to negotiate until maybe President Trump picks up the phone and calls Putin and says, what can we do here? Because General Milley, back when the war started, broke out, told his Congress that was the best time for the United States to cut a deal with Moscow. Because if you recall, in the beginning, Ukraine was doing quite well. Russia was struggling. And so that was the best time, but no one listened. And that was a very ominous prediction that General Milley made. So now we are facing the situation because of this doubling down and because of that ideological sort of aspect of approaching Ukraine conflict. But I wouldn't be surprised at all that if Russia does have designs on Odessa, and it was watching very carefully, I'm sure, what it is that it can absorb into a strategic sort of calculus. Crimea is gone. Eastern Donbass is gone. Excuse me. We all know that Ukraine, since day one, has always been existential to Russia's security. That's like, no matter how we look at it, whether you love Putin, hate Putin, it's irrelevant. What matters is this is sort of a former superpower, now a great power, an emerging power, it's got its priorities, it's got its tastes, so to speak. And when you approach it with such an absolutist, perspective and absolutist sort of disposition, where it's my way or highway, this is the result you get. And yes, you're right. It's enormous tragedy what happened to Ukraine. Enormous. The Ukrainians and Georgians have been friends forever. This is all for nothing, in my opinion. Ukraine could have stayed together. Its sovereignty intact, had this madness not unfolded. And remember, before 2014, when the Maidan quote-unquote revolution took place, nobody cared. Ukraine was just fine. But then we know, Victoria Nuland of the world traveled there and they rallied up the troops. They said, America stands with you, Europe stands with you. This is verbatim. We remember these words in Georgia as well. This was sort of the script that was written. But those who actually did not follow this script and now with this current government in Georgia, I think on the winning side, when the Georgia nation looks back at this decision, I think it will undoubtedly be a very smart, clever, pragmatic decision for Georgia.
I think the history will judge the United States harshly on Ukraine.
Yes.
What they've done, but it seems that still the Biden administration is trying to change the rhetoric, that they're trying to change the facts, the reality of what's going on in Ukraine by saying Russia is losing. Even recently, Donald Trump said more than 600,000 Russian soldiers were killed and wounded. It's unbelievable. The same thing was repeated by Jake Sullivan yesterday.
Yes.
No, it doesn't matter.
Yes.
Ukraine was destroyed and you destroyed it. And do you think that the people, you talk about Caucasus, mm-hmm. How is the understanding in the Caucasus? Are they going to learn from Ukraine? Is that going to be a huge turning point in the mind of these people who are living in those regions? In those regions, in that part of the world, or they're gonna repeat it, and in favor of the United States and destroying themselves.
That's an excellent point. By the way, it's not just the South Caucasus. Central Asia is looking at all five republics of Central Asia are looking at this and thinking we don't want to be part of it. There, it's all trade oriented. It's all geopolitics oriented. So geoeconomic projects that started back in the early 90s till today. From the middle corridor to the BTC, pipelines and railways that the first president Shevardnadze, not first president, but the second president Shevardnadze, who was the former foreign minister of the Soviet Union. He basically put Georgia geoeconomically and geopolitically on the map when they built these strategic pipelines with Azerbaijan, Baku, with the current leader's father, Aliyev, since day one, the analysis, I would argue, has been to use the region for self-sustainment, for geopolitical, in consideration of geopolitical principles and geoeconomic principles, and basically make money. Trade. China has come into Georgia. It has acquired the Black Sea port of Anaklia. Washington was much the chagrin of Washington, of course, when Washington hesitated. By the way, Georgian government wanted for some Western cash to come in into that port project. No one was heard on the other end. No one responded basically from the other end. So China comes in again, very pragmatic calculus, acquires, I think, 51% of the port. So you can see how the entire region is being molded into a sort of self-sustaining geoeconomic and geopolitical, environment, which Georgia should have had paid more attention to since day one. But then this idealistic foreign policy was always part of Georgia. Georgia, way before even, United States existed, wanted to become part of, the 16th, 17th century, wanted to be part of Europe, the West, and there were no takers. So I would argue that geopolitically speaking, you want the West, that's your utopian dream, that's your idealist dream, that's no problem. But when you try to put that into practice and when you try to translate it into foreign policy, knowing full well that you are basically surrounded by very hostile states, you really have a problem. It's a fatal combination, and that part has been ignored. And since the 90s, especially in the post-Cold War world, Georgia has been caught up in this extreme idealistic foreign policy, hoping that one day, NATO would come in into the middle of the Caucasus of all the places, as if no other state there exists that this decision might be, for which this decision might be controversial and unacceptable. But Georgia somehow thought that it would be whisked away and NATO would come in and they would guarantee it. Now, practically speaking, of course, I want Georgia to become a member of NATO or the European Union, because that's the best chance for prosperity, even though there are problems with, say, with the hopes that, European Union will turn Georgia into a rich state. But that's a different sort of economic question. But in terms of security, who doesn't want Georgia to? Every single Georgian, even today, you stop anyone in the street and they will say, of course, I want Georgia to become a member of NATO. But we see the reality. We see how Russia reacts. Ukraine, number one. Georgia, number two. Actually, Georgia was number one before Ukraine in 2008 when this happened to it, when the invasion took place. But and that, by the way, was brushed off as, oh, it's nothing. Russia is just upset and it hates the idea of a democratic prosperity under its, in its periphery. It's the same verbatim. So sort of we are good, you are bad. How can liberalism be bad? How can democracy be bad? In and of themselves, they might not be bad, but that's not what you are doing. What you are doing is you're supporting, autocratic regimes. You call them Democrats. And then when the true much more democratically elected government comes into power, the moment they say, the same foreign policy cannot be sustained, you call that pro-Russian and autocratic. So this constant changing of goalposts is what, not only confused everyone, because everyone understands why this is happening, but compelled Georgia to, develop this pragmatic foreign policy. And there is nothing wrong with that. And by the way, Washington, besides its sort of hysteria and criticism of Georgia, understands that there is not much they can do about it. They cannot overthrow it. Talk about sanctions and other ridiculous things, but they fundamentally, there is not much they can do about it, I believe. And so you know, going back to the sort of a wider region, five republics of Central Asia, obviously including the South Caucasus. Even India is moving in for action because it understands with the new port that is being built now that will go all the way through Russia and north, basically connecting the Indian Ocean with Eurasia. I forgot the name of the port now. I apologize, but you
talk about the North-South corridor.
Correct, North-South corridor and India.
Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, and then India.
That's right. That's right, and it will. It's going up to the transportation routes from sea to the land routes will go up all the way to Helsinki, and so you see how this is being shaped. And then the fundamental question is, actually, I've always wondered about this, because there are conversations behind the scenes taking place where, you know, pragmatic foreign policy of Georgia started, you know, very informal. We have way to go, and this is probably even unrealistic to assume this at this point, but I want to mention it nevertheless, that there could be a conversation between Tbilisi and Moscow of restoration of Georgia's sovereignty with the separatist regions. Just hypothetically speaking, I'm always asking this question. We know that Washington has been a staunch supporter of Georgia's sovereignty and territorial integrity. If that conversation actually moves on to the next level and takes place and says, you know what, thank you, Georgia, for not, you know, for abandoning sort of NATO dreams. And, you know, we appreciate here is the payback. Maybe we can talk about, you know, returning, Abkhazia and South Ossetia to become part of your, Georgian proper with autonomy and whatever technical arrangements there might be. Where is America going to be in this? Are they going to support this process, or are they going to sabotage this process? And where is the collective West going to be? Well, Brussels, for example. Because isn't that why the United States has been wanting Georgia to be a full sovereign nation? And if Georgia figures a way out with Russia, how to achieve that or increase chances to achieve that goal, where is the United States in this equation? So that's, not to mention what is the United States' role in the South Caucasus at all, geopolitically speaking, or in the Black Sea region. And by the way, this got this very sort of Mackinderian flair to it, right? I mean, you know, whoever controls Eurasia controls the world, fine. This is what's sort of the quiet disposition has been in the West. You know, let's try to set fires in various spots in the Russian periphery and see if Russia collapses. This goes back to theory. This goes back to sort of philosophical disposition. But everybody sort of hides this stuff. Everybody says, "Oh no, we just want democracy there, right? We just want Ukraine to prosper." How can you? So this is what's happening, and there are fundamental differences between how Eurasia thinks and countries that exist there, and how the West thinks about these things. And the main culprit here is the Western desire to destroy Russia, which has not worked. Just the idea alone is, in my opinion, an extreme, unsustainable idea.
Delusional. Totally,
yeah,
delusional.
It's exactly right. Delusional. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Lasha, for being with us today. Great pleasure to
Thank
have you,
you very
on.
Much. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm sure we'll continue this.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.